So welcome to this session. With apologies to Chris Christofferson, this session is called The Walking Contradiction, Partly Truth and Partly Fiction. And the truth part comes now. You folks who feel kind of more comfortable in the back, I want to urge you to come up. Would you please? We want to feel like we're part of the group here. Thank you so much. She led the way. Follow, please. And one hold out. Come on up.
No, he won't. He has to go sometimes.
You can, even if you have to leave early, you can do that, but please come up. I'm sorry, I'm being you're not gonna do it now. Coercion is not part of this panel. Okay. Well, welcome to a panel of terrific fiction writers. I want to excuse one panelist who will not be here today. That's Richard Terry LaPointe, Rick LaPointe as he's known. He's in the East with his parents and won't be here. And we'll miss him, but we'll bring him back another time. So I want to introduce you to the panelists, and then they will, after each of their readings from three separate works of fiction, very disparate, very challenging, very interesting stuff. We will open, we will maybe have a brief discussion among ourselves up here, and then we'll open it to your questions, and would invite you, when that happens, to come up to the microphone so that your question will be recorded. On my left, immediate left, is Faye Ellsworth from Virgin, Utah. You know, I can repeat exactly what it says in the program bios, but I don't think I'm going to do that. You've got them in front of you. These are people who have, all of them, interesting and different backgrounds, but take your cue from the written material so that we'll have more time to have the readings. So we'll start off with Faye Ellsworth, second will be Larry Whitby, and finally Whitney Maurer. And I am so happy to see, when I come to Sunstone, and see that young people, there is another generation who are not only terrific writers, but who are interested in what goes on here at Sunstone. And I only met Whitney Maurer a couple of months ago, and I was extremely impressed with what she read and invited her to be part of this panel. So we'll start with Faye Ellsworth.
The Spit of God. This is fiction. I'm a greenhorn. I've only lived in Charity, Utah for 10 years, and since I lost my husband, I decided to write my life story, tell the long bad marriage and short good one. There's one problem. I carry the beginnings of my story, or if I were pretentious, my memoir, with me. I don't write except for one chapter I started, Crop Failure, where I interspersed quotes from the Irish potato famine to demonstrate the kick I got out of writing how my small H husband treated our kids during the divorce. The spores attack and devour the plant's juice within a few weeks. The potato becomes a black, sodden pulp. I carry these around in a folder. Just yesterday, I was carrying it down the hill to get the mail. Our town is so small, we don't have mail delivery. I asked my neighbor, Golda, who's watering her pansies, you know, the ones on the metal table with the two gnomes. One of them is on a frog, and the other one is writing a snail. They're kind of like my son's gnomes in his front yard, only he put those little red LED lights in the eyes at twilight. It gives it a distinctly sinister feel in his front yard. I greeted her, said how good the pansies looked. After the rain, of course, she glanced down at my folder. I leaned forward and lifted it up and down like I was doing a smudging ceremony and said, I'm writing my life story. I might add, I also said those two words as if they were capitalized. And I brought the folder slowly back down. Why? No malice, no accusation, not even real curiosity. Golda's my best friend. We're fond of calling each other sisters. And I go there, I admit it, occasionally for coffee. I put about an inch of the brown liquid in the cup, fill it with milk. I like it that it's a chipped cup because it kind of reminds me of my childhood when we drink barley coffee, only my dad called it barley coffee. And I said, Glenda, I'll only drink this on one condition. Golda, I only drink this on one condition. You don't tell anyone. At that moment, her daughter, the one who makes the beautiful greeting cards, called and she said, Fran and I are just here having coffee. So, of course, I couldn't do it anymore. She didn't change her expression as I told her I was writing my memoir. But her gracefully arched eyebrows stayed arched. I thought of the women in my ward who have perpetually arched eyebrows. The old bishop's new wife does this for a living. But she seemed to be expecting an answer. I looked at the handmade doghouse their beagle Elvis used to live in before he died, because he ain't nothing but a hound dog. And now the silence did become awkward. A hawk circled. I looked up. Red tail, then said as if it were part of the same session, I think it's a good time to do it. More silence. You know, while I still have my mind. You know how I said we refer to each other as sisters? An example was just the day before when we took a red verbena to our visiting teaching lady. Golda got the planter at Ballard's and declined when I offered to split the cost. And she used the card her daughter had made for her, the one I mentioned. She just took out the insert. Sister Sandra attended her twin sons after his wife left. Of course, this was before they'd been diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. Sister Sandberg, yes, I made all the names up, but you can find them out if you really want to. They're pretty close if you do your homework. They call her Mama. I guess that's what her husband calls her. In church, if you've ever been around fetal alcohol kids, as you can imagine, they're kind of rowdy. Their husband sits in the back, fellowshipping other people. Sometimes she'd lose her temper and pinch the boy's ear and he'd yelp. And when he grew older, he'd whine, "You're so mean to me!" No one would move their head or even their eyes. But I lead the music. I sit on the stand, so I don't miss much. The kid's dad remarried a woman with four kids of her own. And they sat in the row behind Mama and wouldn't sit with her anymore. That's why Golda and I were bringing her the verbena. I had Golda write Jean's name on the envelope because her handwriting is so fancy. I wrote how the plant would bloom and grow like the kids under her care. On her side, she wrote, "It is spring." When my husband and I first moved here and I was Jean's visiting teacher, we didn't say the prayer, but we probably should have. I'd just cry in the driveway. Don't make me go in there. I couldn't stand her complaining. The way she would disparage her husband and the twins, not even mentioning that she yelled at him and sometimes slapped the boy across the face. I held him when he cried and stroked his arm. Someone once asked me after church in my flinching days if I'd been the one to turn Jean into family services. I said no. I thought of it, but I didn't do it. When we first moved here and built our house from four BYU recycled married student housing trailers from the 70s, we pulled them apart one by one. I brought her a treat every month, little things like candles, candy, perfume, lotion. But the last time I came, I didn't bring him after that. I made a plate of fudge for Valentine's Day, put it in a heart-shaped plate. Sure fudge, my mom's recipe. A good one, with guitar chocolate, marshmallows, and real butter. When she answered the door, she looked at the plate and said, "Chocolate gives me diarrhea." "Are you sure you want to reject my little gift?" I said. Like a prisoner holding the last meal, offering the last meal, but instead of stopping, she tightened her knuckles on the screen door and said, "Yes. I normally don't waste food, but I just turned, drove home, and threw it in the trash, card, plate, and all. I got the plate. My visiting teaching ladies at the All a Dollar Store in St. George. It's next to Pier 1, but I haven't been there since my husband died. The strange part about his death was not the heart attack. After having a complete physical 2 weeks earlier, or even the naked, I came into the world naked, I went out, quality of it, as he was heading for the jacuzzi, his last words being, "Will you be joining me in the jacuzzi this morning, my darling?" But then a month or so earlier, we had a very playful conversation about his funeral. "If you should be the one to go first, wishes. You know how those conversations can take on a life of their own? So," I had said, poking him in the arm, "how many verses if you could die to call up?" And I swear I said that. "Do you want for the closing song? What kind of deli sandwiches?" I had carried out his wishes to the letter after the funeral. After the funeral, but before the lunch, I walked into the kitchen, past the kitchen, and heard this. "Funeral potatoes. She thinks she's too good for us." I walked right in. No, I marched in, put my arms around each of the women. That kitchen got silent pretty fast and said, "Would it be possible to just lay this to rest right now?" After the lunch, we released 135. I wanted 100, but I got 35 in case of breakage. Red, yellow, and orange balloons. My daughter-in-law brought colored pencils and watercolors, and we wrote messages. But as the months went by, I felt an urgency to scatter his ashes. In Zion, the place he loved best, everyone I mentioned to pointed out it was against the law. If they had just said against the rules, I probably would have done it anyway. But the word illegal and the rather free, random sound and feel of the word scattering were two words I didn't want to be in the same sentence, not to mention life. Then recently, and this has been 3 years now, I woke up one morning and decided to scatter them not in one place, but in all the places we've gone on our grand circle tours, 8 days and 7 nights. Before he died. Hold it. I just said the word died. I hadn't said that for the whole first year. No, I said it twice. Died. Took a year before I could even think, let alone write that word. I traveled light. A bottle of Centrum Silver for women, okay, over 50, and a jar of peanut butter. And when I came back from my 5-day odyssey, I wrote a poem which I didn't share with anyone. It made me too sad to even think about it, let alone read. I reduced the journey to 3 elements: Sarah Brightman music, sunsets, and of course the ashes. Well, I did read the poem once now that I'm thinking of it for a writing group about nature. That's when I wrote it. It was a free workshop, so I attended it. The assignment was inner image, outer image. I started the poem by looking out my living room window at a sacred datura and talked about scattering his heavy white. Then, at the north rim, when the wind whirled the ashes up, leaving a patina on my arm, I wrote that I had cut a white pink path across my hand. First I put highway, then I put road, then I put path. A man with bad breath who stood too close to me after the workshop told me he liked that part the best. Please don't judge me for carrying the blue plastic folder. It has blank sheets of paper, but I did put the What Is Rain poem in it, as well as an extensive reading list of memoir books. Maybe I just like the shade of blue. It's like the sky during the balloon release. It may mean incurring the wrath of my small-age husband if I use the Irish potato quotes. So I'm ambivalent about using the one that refers to the fungus Phytophthora infestans releasing several million spores a day. which may not only be interpreted as this unrelenting meanness, but also have an unwanted sexual connotation. I do look forward to this chapter, though. Dad didn't mean to cut your head off. I jotted it down during a telephone conversation with my daughter, who was defending him for photoshopping me out of her wedding pictures. My visiting teacher woman, Jean, cried the first time we stepped into that living room with the flowers, the verbena. We're not here as visiting teacher, Goldu said. We're here as friends, I said. She cried again even harder when she read the card. And Golda said, I think I can say I know how you feel, because I have 4 of my children and grandchildren living with me and do everything for them. I chose a spot next to the Pioneer Cemetery for the headstone. I told Golda I wanted to be her neighbor and even put some of the ashes in the dirt. I got it so I'd have something to kick. I think the best poem I wrote, though, was I wrote a poem called Purchase, but I think the best one was the sonnet. Upon hearing, I wrote it in my bedroom when Packrat was chewing on my leather watchman next to the back door, and I mistook the sound as my husband tried to get in. The last line is, Darling, my voice is clear and true. Darling, is it you? As I was walking down to the mail this morning, I noticed Gold had put some snowball plants in a vase in front of the headstone. I love my town of Charity. In Relief Society, my best friend, who happens, 27, who happens to have Down syndrome, in the Charity Relief Society, she leads the music I play. For 2 years, we met for half an hour every Sunday morning before Relief Society to learn As I Have Loved You. When the steak music lady came and talked about music, we took her in the Relief Society room and sang what I call our showstopper. Broom, 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 broom. As I have loved you, love one another. Good, Leisha. This new commandment, love one another. Belt it, Leisha, belt it loud now. But this shall all know. If ye have loved one to another, big breath, Alicia, big breath. Well, we were going to do a gig at the Senior Citizen Center. We're working on Moonlight in Vermont. I thought something spiritual, something secular. But the same woman with the arched eyebrows with the tattoo came up, and I don't want to say who it is, and said, when I told her, they'll let anybody come there. Here's what I don't get. Why she wouldn't let her pick her own songs. They would put them on the board and I'd write the numbers, but if I didn't do it dark enough, that woman would copy over my letters and make them darker. So I suggested, and Alicia made a list. It was all her favorite songs. The first one said the Spit of God, one of her favorite hymns. When my good husband and I first moved to Mexico, that was right before we built the house, we were walking in rainy Mazatlan streets at night, and he turned to me and said, what is rain? Rain is angels crying for the tender children who've been harmed, I said. He didn't say anything. Heavenly Father's way of washing the world clean. It's a metaphor for repentance. He didn't say anything. Finally, he said, what is the Spanish word for rain? I would say it's the Spit of God. kind of God that someone goes unpunished for saying to Leisha, when we had our first gig, they'll take anybody and then lets good men die. Well, that's my life, the things I did. We built the house, purchased the headstone to Kip. My sister said that was expensive. I said, consider cost per wear over the years, though. Presented a plant to Mama. We ended up singing at the Senior Citizen Song. I took a hero's journey. And now I'm going to write. Self-centered and arrogant as it may seem, my writing book says it can almost approach the sacred. It's time. It's time. I'll quit toting my little blue folder, buckle down, and write my memoir. Oh, it's not all sad things. There were funny things. My oldest son, the one with the red-eyed gnome, when he was little, about six, and I gave him a crust of my homemade whole wheat bread, he stared at it and said, I feel like a peasant. Or that how I used to reach, he'd say, excuse me for reaching at the dinner table. Really, I will do this thing while I still have my mind.
The Philosopher's House, Chapter 1. She knew from the expression on the attorney's dour face that there was trouble. The nervous smile, the twitchy movement of his gloomy eyebrows, a mist of sweat on his pallid receding hairline. He'd avoided eye contact from the beginning. It all caused her to sit down. Her heart became alarmed in anticipation. How's your relationship with your sister-in-law, Peter's sister? He asked while staring at a document. You mean Alice? Yes, Alice Rankin. He finally offered eye contact. Well, not very good. Why? I'm sorry to say that Peter apparently assigned the survivorship of his estate to her back in 1987 before he met you, before you were married. Her lips parted in disbelief and she froze. He continued, but I don't see the house included. Do you own that or is that in joint tenancy? As far as I can recollect, we both signed on that. We bought it soon after the marriage. What constitutes his estate then? Well, it expressly includes his 401k, his automobiles, that would be those with his name on the title, all his other possessions, property, other than that which is also in your name, his art collection, the boat, the cabin on Sundown Lake, and his gold coins, all the assets in a CMA portfolio at Merrill Lynch, the checking account at Wells Fargo, if your name is not on it too, technically, anything that doesn't have your name on the title. I doubt if I'm on the Wells Fargo account. We've kept our own checking accounts over the years. You mean he didn't change this after our marriage? You'd be surprised how often this happens. And it's a real problem when somebody dies suddenly like Peter did. Okay, well, so that's how the story opens. And let me just leapfrog a little here. In short, this character that I'm trying to develop, Suzanne Williams, married at around age 40, sort of late in life, already a tenured professor of metaphysics, philosophy, successful in her career, marries a man a little older, wealthy, who wants her to retire relatively early now at age 58,
So she's available to travel with him and enjoy life. And during the next few chapters, she goes through very painful maneuvers with the state attorneys and others, and basically loses all the marital assets except the house, which also still has a mortgage. And it's a grand Tudor-style mansion a few blocks from campus, built in the 1920s, and she doesn't want to lose that. And so she decides, in order to survive, to rent out rooms, and because she's close to the campus. And so I want to introduce a couple of characters, several characters that enter her life by renting rooms from her. So let me just flip over some chapters. Basically, the time frame is it's several months after the death of her husband. It's summer. She's always had this tradition of going to Berlin for a couple of months during her vacation to do research in metaphysics. She'd done a Fulbright there 33 years ago. And so now she's not going to let the death of her husband interfere with this and her financial condition. So she's going to Berlin. And while she's in Berlin, we're focusing on an event that occurs at the house back in Iowa, where she lives. It was early August when Bruce Gardner rang the doorbell of Suzanne's grand house in Iowa City. A tall, overweight young woman in khaki shorts and a long gray t-shirt answered the door. She held a book in her hand and peered through plastic-framed glasses. "Hi, I'm Bruce Gooding. I'm looking for Suzanne Williams, and I've been told this is where she lives." His voice was assuring with a cavernous quality. "It is, but she's in Germany. I'm just the house sitter." She was an unmarried graduate student in the philosophy department, eager to live rent-free in Suzanne's house in return for watering plants, depositing bill payments, answering the telephone, and leaving lights on when she was away in the evening. "I've been told that she's renting out rooms. I'm in need of one on a temporary basis and wondered whether there's one available." "Yes, she has pre-rented two and has other applications for the other three. I can only take your application if you want." "She will decide whom to accept when she returns in about 10 days. In any event, move-in cannot occur before the 15th of August." "Sure. Do you have something for me to fill out?" She invited him into the entry hall. "So here is where Suzanne lives." He quickly surveyed the hall and peeked through the archway into the living room. He stepped forward with interest and scrutinized the room for too long a time, on the brink of leering. The oak floors were covered with Persian hariz carpets. The overstuffed furniture was contemporary with plain fabrics. Two black leather and chrome Barcelona chairs stood at the end of the two sofas. A great built-in bookcase bulging with volumes, none of them being mail order sets of the classics or books of the month, lined the northern wall, and an eclectic collection of paintings hung chock-a-block English style on the other walls. A black baby grand piano occupied the shadowed corner. "Does she play the piano?" The girl looked at him, surprised by his interest. "Yes, but I heard her only once at a departmental holiday party, accompanying a student who was singing a parody of some kind. She wasn't too bad. As I recall, the singer had the lesser talent." The girl smiled for the first time. Surreptitiously, he studied every detail of the environment as if deriving thereby stored up elan vital, some mysterious gas that he could breathe in at a later time to energize and stimulate himself with. Finally, about when he felt the girl might think him strange for his pathological interest in this space, he sat down to fill out the form. While he wrote, the girl, as one interested but not experienced in men, studied him. About 6 feet one, slim body except for a mild roll over his belt, black shoes, leather, expensive and well polished, a starched green fishing shirt with button flap pockets on the breast. His nose was well cut but reddened by the sun, as was his broad forehead, leading up to a full head of salt and pepper hair, obviously professionally cut and fastidiously combed, leaving a lopsided but charming bang on the left side. Wrinkles ruffled the eyes and mouth of his otherwise handsome face. "Why are you looking for a room?" The man looked too well off to be rooming with students in an off-campus house. "I'm here for about 6 months working on a research project at the university. I prefer being in a home environment instead of a hotel, and I want to be able to walk to campus." He looked up at her, seeking her satisfaction with the answer. "I see," she said, then nervously continued down an irrelevant line of conversation. "Professor Williams is a very interesting but also a very kind person. I'm sure you would like her." What this graduate student didn't know was that he already liked her. He had liked her for 40-some years. She was his first, and on many occasions thought to be his only love. BG, as he had been known as in high school, had flown to Iowa City with one purpose in mind: to track down Suzanne Williams. 2 weeks ago, he had bumped into a former high school friend at an airport. They had chatted, and the friend said, "Hey, I didn't see you at the 40th class reunion in Baltimore." "I hate going to those. They make me feel old. Everybody looks gray, wrinkled, puffy-like." The friend brought Bruce up to date on the latest: who had been divorced, who had died, who was unrecognizable. Bruce had asked, "Was Suzanne Williams there?" "Was she there?" He had answered as if to say, "Are you kidding? She was a hit of the show." "How's that?" "She was voted the least change." "Wow, is she well preserved? I mean, her hair is grayed a bit, but she still has a pretty decent figure after all these years." "Unbelievable. Trim, very, very good looking, perfect teeth. I took a couple of classes with her, English and political science, I believe. And she still has that aura of gravity, you know, intellectual confidence, oddly mixed with some shyness. You know what I mean? She was a bit sad, though, because her husband had just died suddenly, I guess, from a heart attack." "She's a widow?" Bruce had shot back with obvious heightened interest. "Yeah, she's quite a gal. Speaks German and reads ancient Greek. Did her PhD in philosophy, as I recall. She just retired from the University of Iowa." This encounter sent Bruce's mind soaring like a model airplane out of range of its controller. She probably would not remember him, but he has remembered her for 40-plus years. In high school, he had dated her once. A five-hour affair, overplanned by his anxiety, doomed to failure, filled with too many activities, most of them, in retrospect, being dumb with lame outcomes and punctuated with voids of roaring silence. They went from a video arcade to an Italian restaurant, onto a Bach concert in a church, onto what nowadays would be called a discotheque, onto a friend's house to play silly games with people she didn't know, onto a stop at a faraway lake to watch the stars in an ill-founded hope of making intimate progress, and then, exhausted, onto her home where she had politely thanked him and strode directly up to the porch, through the door, without looking back. This pitiful event, a death march, Suzanne had described it to her mother, occurred in the final months of his senior year, which did not allow him enough time to concoct and embark upon a new initiative, finagle a retry, and recoup his losses before they graduated and went their separate ways. That was the last he saw of her. But the fantasy of Suzanne had stayed in his memory like lead poisoning in the bones, ineradicable, popping up here and asserting itself there, even to the point of feeding his sexual fantasies. Googling her, he had recently identified her academic career, but couldn't find out where she lived. His internet searches delivered only obscure bibliographic titles of philosophy, ostensibly authored by her. Gottlob Frege's Reliance on an Imperfect Arithmetic Model, or Russell and Frege, Respectful Competitors Crafting a New Paradigm. These glimpses, like shadows in Plato's cave, only motivated him to find out more. But he came to a dead end and was distracted from going forward by his own marriage, which was falling inevitably apart. Let's see. And I got another five.
Sure.
Yeah. Let me just read just a little bit. I'm skipping way ahead here. Now she's back from Germany. On August 29th, standing around Suzanne's dining table, five new renters chatted and munched on cookies she had bought that afternoon. Three men and two women. Jet-lagged and tired, the new and inexperienced landlord had called the, quote, orientation meeting to introduce the strangers to each other. Please, everybody take a chair. I'm a bit nervous since I have never had strangers living in my house before. I think it would be a good thing for you to understand what I expect from this arrangement. I would like to be in a position to call you by name, so please introduce yourselves. The young man to her right, chubby in his loose jeans and two large t-shirts, sporting a substantial red beard, removed his iPod earphones and with seriousness that betrayed an uneasy shyness, stated that he was from Des Moines and was a sophomore majoring in computer science. The female next to him, groomed and cute, was from a farm to the north and was not a student, just a working girl. The next female spoke with eye contact and an actor-like quality. Her long, straight black hair framed a jutting nose that looked to Suzanne like a ski jump. She was a senior, mirthful by nature, majoring in voice, opera, in fact. She hoped her afternoon rehearsals at the living room piano with prior approval from Suzanne would not disturb the other roomers. At the far side of the table sat Bruce Gardner, who introduced himself as Bruce Gooding, someone conducting research at the university for a short time. The next male was a sophomore from Cedar Rapids, majoring in economics and Spanish. In September, he had just returned from a two-year mission for the Mormon Church in Ecuador. His hair was too well trimmed for a college student. He smiled frequently and spoke with a well-bred air of confidence. Suzanne recognized him as good-looking and asked why he wasn't attending Brigham Young University, where most Mormons seem to go. My mother is not in good health, and I would rather stay closer to her for now. Suzanne summarized. I confess I'm not good at names, and I have this chronic neurosis of assigning nicknames to people I meet so I can remember them. Any problem if I assign each of you a nickname? They welcomed it. Now, curiously, they awaited their new names. Pointing to the student to her right, she said, you are in some people's eyes a geek or a nerd. Those are too pejorative for such a nice guy. So I think I'll call you Barbarossa, after Friedrich Barbarossa, the German emperor who led the Crusades. He was known for his red beard and his courage. Would that be okay? He liked it. He worked up a faint smile and nodded in the affirmative. And you, looking at the farm girl from the north, I'd like to call you the damsel, because you were young and attractive, okay? The girl looked uneasy and said, nah, I'm not sure what a damsel is. It does hold a swear word, damn. But I don't suppose that has anything to do with it, does it? No, it has nothing to do with swearing. It is a good thing, positive. A young, cute girl. I'll use some other nickname if you want. No, 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 that's right with me. I'll be the damsel. I'll look it up later. But she still seemed a bit disappointed, so Suzanne offered another. I insist that we drop the damsel. How about worker chick? Oh, I like that one. She was very happy. Suzanne turned then to the opera singer and said, we would call you prima donna, but that has a negative connotation. You've just got to be the diva girl. Will that work for you? Sure, I guess that's what I'm aiming for. I'll give it something to live up to. Turning to Bruce Gardner, she said, we could call you Bruce Almighty, but that would be trite. No offense, but I never quite liked the name Bruce. So, what should we call you? How about BG for Bruce Gooding? BG it will be then. He winced a bit inside to learn that she didn't like the name Bruce. Could that have been the problem from the beginning? Finally, turning to the returned Mormon missionary, she said, how about Sparky Boy for you? That's positive, wouldn't you say? I like it, he agreed. But what will your name be? I don't know. A nickname should come from you, not me. They all looked around and offered, Big Mama, Philosophy Lady, Socratette, Susie Q, Miss Landlord. None of them became unanimously supported. Then they concluded that all those showed insufficient respect for the landlady. So they settled on the professor. And she agreed to it. Barbarossa, worker chick, diva girl, BG, and Sparky Boy listened to the professor lay down the policies. She printed up her sheet of rules. Oh, I'm over time. Should I quit? I'll quit.
I'll leave it to you.
I'll quit. Thank you very much.
Hello. I'm going to read from a short story called At the Limits of the City. At night, the city was very still because the people did not stay out late, unless it was the eve of the 4th of July when all the families put blankets down on either side of the main street and spent the night awake and on bicycles, holding glow sticks and bags of mixed candy to wait for the morning parade. The people of this city were patriotic and prayed often and studied much and thought of the Lord always, wide glowing eyes and burning hearts. They handed him their bodies every day and gave up all doubt. They covered their shoulders. The restaurants closed early. The college locked its doors at 10 o'clock from the outside. Night was a different kind of time there. The mountains blotted out the sky in all directions. The cars on the road seemed to drive slower. Headlights, as they passed, stained the darkness behind a vehicle for a few moments with white. It was as if time suspended itself in short intervals there in the night in the city. Figures were in constant merger, desert into mountain into road. And then there was the lake at night, mosquitoes thick and indecipherable from the black of the mountains until they hit your face in the dark like the branch of a pine. There was the copper mine, the largest excavation in the world, and from it a red mineral that shines. Once a deer may have grazed near the pit, acid in its veins, but later the pit filled with garbage and the deer moved down from the mountain to the city. The younger brother pulls his car to the side of the road and opens the door for the girl. His eyes are fixed on something outside, beyond the car. Ren puts her hand on his thigh. She keeps it still and firm. The younger brother is heavy with thought. He sweats, has not slept for many days. But they arrive at the lake and are okay. Ren is angry. In other places, young people do not dream about heaven. They say bad words, and all the boys love girls and want to touch them all the time. Ren's best friend in school went to prom with a boy who, after the dance, shoved his fingers under the skirt of her royal blue dress. Ren's best friend said she was in love. Later, Ren saw him in church passing bread and water. He was not worthy to feed us Christ. His name was Daniel, and he did flips and handstands at patriotic assemblies like some human firework. He was too old for his grade. He bounced when he walked, had big moles on his arms, wore a necklace with a stone on it. The younger brother's eyes are green, and the moon is bright in them. She wants to stay in the car and put her hand on his shoulder to rest. She remembers that sleeping next to him has always been easy, when it is usually not easy in her own bed. Ren doesn't know that there is gravel in his skin. He takes her to a building. "I want to take you to a building," he says. They walk to where the road turns into sand, and he says he is taking her somewhere safe. Next to the mine, there are old structures and newer ones, facilities built and then forgotten when new technology arrived, easier to rebuild than revise, a civilization that every few years immigrates to more fruitful land. Ren pictures hard-working men in boots who speak with economy, grease in their knuckles and tear ducts. These buildings are now obsolete, full with dead machinery and pipes, mold and pounds of metal. Memories here do not grow. They get lost in the inches of rust. So he takes her arm where it bends and leads her to a structure cut off from the light of the city. The miners left this place. This is the place where the slope of one mountain meets the land, leaving a great space until the next mountain begins. The people who live inside the valley do not often visit the dark beside the turbid lake and old factory. The people think of it as a type of edge. They are not a people who wish to run into the empty space beneath the sun. Frightening things happen here, they say. Ren and the younger brother are still walking in the dark. Ren wishes the younger brother would take her and kiss her, but he never does. They are coming to something. Surrounding an old building, a chain fence stands, creased and kicked at its middle by trespassers. They walk through the fence and into the building. The younger brother tells her to look. He says this is important. "I see nothing," she says. "There is an elevator," says the younger brother. "I don't like this. It's getting very late. Please, let me show you," he says. "Is this safe?" "I don't know if it is safe," she says. "I love you, and your mother wants you to see my plan." He says this, putting her palm on the up button, moist and rough with rust, difficult to push in. "Darling," she says, "you are in a fever tonight. Though you don't know a thing about my mother, you're smart, fair, and I will go." Ren finds herself in a room of cans and jugs. There are safes against one wall, stacked in rows, all open. Everywhere is black clothing hung from mile-long rods that stretch across the ceiling. "This is for when the world ends," he says. "What is this place for? This is my plan. This is how we will be all right." Hands on her neck, he guides her through the room. The younger brother goes into a trance. He has been in a trance for as long as she has known him. The place echoes and muffles the sounds from outside in a frightening way. Ren thinks it sounds like space must sound, or like the ocean she has never seen, like how a seashell might sound when pressed against an ear. He touches her, and he kisses her, and she lets him. For this she has waited. "Marry me," he says. "Marry me in the White Temple, and we will live forever." For some time, the children who dwell at the limits of the city wish to change, but they remain young. A boy and girl dream about their lost mothers. They try to dream, as others do, about the story of the afterlife that is written in the book, a story that spills forth with conviction from the mouths of the older men and women. "Should we dream of golden clothing?" the boy asks. "God's hands touching our hands?" "Should we dream we have our very own stars?" asks the girl. In the city, a boy and girl talk about the end of the world. The great marble statue of Christ, violent and white against a dark galaxy, has never made me cry. I cry when a young boy won't kiss me, when I stand with him at the edges of a city and see that he stands not with me but for the end. He stands for rapture, I to wait. I cry for him, for the body I want near mine, for careful shoulders bare and free. I cry now that my mother is gone, to make up for the sisters, brothers, parents too drunk on heaven to cry. I walk the tip of the lake on the day of chastity. Under my dress I wear shorts, cut church, and through brush I go to corn and rust. I imagine my lover's long yearning hands, or my mother's figure in the water pushing up to the surface. If the spirits of the city cannot leave, I am sure this lake is what keeps them here. Where is she lost, if not in this dark, irrecoverable water, this city where I am lost, where he is lost, past these peaks and beyond the division of gravity? Is this where heaven must be? A dream of three things, my mother, the end, the day the younger brother sees me in a place other than the future. I dream while awake and while asleep. In Earth's last days, we locked ourselves in a room. You caught a disease from a chemical which made your hair turn white and grow rapidly. Halfway down your back, the hair would grow, and every few hours I would cut it. With plastic hooks, we wove it into rags to make scarves. Because our clothes were many layers of coarse fabric we'd found and wrapped around ourselves in such odd and hurried ways, we couldn't make love. To touch skin, we needed to cut the fabric. We had no knife, so I put my hands into you where they would fit, and sometimes I got to your collarbone, your knee. The streets were quiet and glassy like Christmas Eve. The streets were always this way. From the sliver window of our room, I watched the world in a stupor, a cold cessation. I perched on a crate for hours and did not see one object or creature move. There was ice, but never rain. Nothing white dropped soft onto the road. How was this ice made? I am young and in love, and what is God's will? I said again and again. Though I am young, my hair went white, you said, when you found me that day in the street, thawing a peach with my breath. You took me to a safe room where we prayed, said little else. A man knocked at the door once. I have found you, he said. You opened the door and strangled him with a black snake. I asked where you had found it. From the broken floor, you said, where there are hundreds. At the limits of the city, cans of food and jars of rice line the walls of a secret room. I have seen the room myself. He has taken me there in a trance and pushed me into black clothing, safes, storage for the end. This is my plan, he says, and I will never learn to kiss you. 3 miles from where the two-faced demigod was taken, I go there. On the day of chastity, I go while my lover is hidden away in a church for hours making love to the word. When I enter, the room echoes like fear. Sometimes my people find me in the barren field, and how can I tell them about the end, the lake's collection of souls, the goods stacked in a secret room of obsession? How can I tell them I do not live for Kolob, but for the hour that I might be given his careful bare shoulders? Let me tell you how I love a man, I want to say when they find me sitting in corn or concrete. Let me tell you of careful shoulders, bare and free. If I seem bewildered or misshapen when they come, my people are not rattled. They sing to me, bless me. Calmly, rhythmically, their faces open and close. They lead me not to ecstatic rooms of angels, but to plywood and beige brick, reason and modernity. They explain. Methinks the spirit whispers, no man has found pure space, nor seen the outside curtains where nothing has a place. I do not speak when they speak, I look them in the eyes. My lips form a straight, reasonable line, fire on fire. Thank you.
Yeah. Well. We've been introduced into three separate worlds and allowed to look around and feel what's going on and make our own interpretations of the inner workings of these stories. I want to ask just a couple of questions of the panel, and then I would like to open it to you to ask your own questions, make your own comments, whatever you wish to do. I'm interested first about your plans and hopes for publication of these tales, because I want to see them on paper and hold them in front of me. And then I would like to ask you to comment briefly if you are, if you will, on I guess the title of our session, which is Walking Contradiction, Partly Truth and Partly Fiction. How does one, in writing fiction, rely upon one's own experience, one's life with people in the real world and adapt or bounce off of or use as springboards to fiction, the real events that make up our lives? How do you how do you adapt one to the other? And the answer will probably be different for each of you, but if you want to take a swing at those for a moment, and then we'll open it to your questions.
Ladies before gentlemen.
But you're the published author.
Touché.
Well, I do, if I could ever finish this novel, I will. I do plan to have it published. And my first novel, took 7 years to get done. And I went through it 31 times in terms of editing it myself. And it was just long and arduous, so I don't know what the future date will be for this book, but I'm into the story. My first book was so autobiographical that my family, friends, and associates really believed it was an autobiography, and when the character got into real trouble, they believed that I'd been through all that trouble, and so it took an amount of time to clarify to them that it was really fiction. It was sort of a Larry Rigby run amok, so to say. And so in this book, I decided to try something very, very challenging and go completely away from a male character. And I'm doing something that many of my writer friends say, including Paul, is somewhat suicidal, to try and get into the brain and mind of a woman and to become sort of, to develop that character. It's tough to do, but I'm hoping that I'm coming along with that in this book. And
I really admire that you're taking that risk. I think it will stretch your prose and give you new insights into yourself as well.
Yeah, so that's the word from...
Like what we thought. That was interesting to me because, well, this is Faye, and what Larry just said about making fiction autobiographical is what I'm doing in a series of short stories that are going to be my life story. But I got the idea, and if anyone's doing the memoir, I cannot recommend highly enough Tristine Renier's Your Life is Story, where she says, you know, the same author who wrote The New Diary, Tristine Renier, if you can't remember it, make it up.
Yeah, good.
I'm not particularly good at articulating my writing process quite yet. It's something that's hard to express, but I guess I had a teacher one time who would ask us, prompt us to ask ourselves, what do you not remember about something that happened to you? And I think that's a really good way to start a story. Think of something that, I don't know, that you've gone through, and then ask yourself what you don't remember, and kind of make a collage of those pieces, putting those together. That's all I have. That's nice. I'm writing that down.
Okay.
We'll feel bad if you don't ask any.
Come on up and come to the microphone and throw something out to these people and put them on the spot a little bit. Don't be shy.
It's like testimony. You have to have the first person come up.
Yeah.
You've got questions. You've got comments. We'll wait while you decide to do it. All right, here we go.
Well, I don't have any particular questions, but I would really like to congratulate the panel for what they do and what they're doing. It just gives me great hope for writing. I knew Faye when she was a student.
26 years old. Southern Utah. Vietnam protest.
Larry and I.
Whitney,
sorry. But the just looking at the youth and on up, you know, through the generations, as a writer myself, I think it might be good for all of us to hear what some of their background and influences have been, the kind of writers they like and things that have happened to particularly inspire them from the tradition, both for Latter-day Saint.
Great.
Well, I read a wide variety of fiction writers. I love to read fiction, and as well as philosophy and criticism and those kinds of things. But my favorite novelists right now are probably everybody else's that's at least literary or oriented. I like Coetzee, I like Ian McEwan, I like Cormac McCarthy, I love reading John Updike and Philip Roth, I read Marianne Robinson once in a while, those are the types that I read. I love to read what's the short story writer, the woman from Canada? What's her name? She's so good.
What? Louise Erdek?
No.
Is she from Canada?
No. Why am I having the senior block here?
Alice Munro.
Alice Munro. Yeah, I just love reading her. And the woman short story writer from Mississippi. Who's that? You're the one with the sharp mind who died a few years ago.
Carson McCullers?
No. Anyway, those are the types I like to read, and my background is in business, in an entrepreneur, so I have a lot of exposures with attorneys and a lot of different people, and dealing with problems a lot, and I try to incorporate a lot of those because I understand them and have experienced them into my fiction.
Well, I think Larry's my literary soulmate, just what he said. And then, what else? I was one of those BYU English majors in the late 60s that we called kind of like we were the true English majors, not using it just to go get your business degree and having it as a good broad undergraduate degree. So I was kind of a snob, I think, and bookish all my life. But when my husband died, I felt compelled to write, although I journaled over the years, haphazardly I'd say, but it came out in poetry, and I call it the Out of the Clear Blue Sky series. And I have an MFA in art also, and I took the text and put it in with the paintings, and I had a bun with long hair, and I actually used his hair in the art, and smeared pomegranate juice and so forth. I was lucid at that time. It wasn't some kind of frenzied madwoman thing, but it was very therapeutic, and I had a one-woman show with that called Out of the Clear Blue Sky.
Which, if you haven't noticed in Faye's bio in the program, Faye is an artist of prodigious talent.
Let's see. When I was living in Western Utah as a high school student, brand new neighborhood, just like pure suburban, no trees, nothing yet. I think someone gave me 100 Years of Solitude for my birthday, and I think I was like 15 or something, and I'd like to read before that, but I found that book and stayed up all night reading it, and then I just decided that I wanted to be an English major when I came to college, and somehow I got into the path, go to graduate school and be a creative writer. But I'm a big fan of McCarthy, too. I've always been a Hemingway fan, and I love Charles Simic, too, among others. So.
Okay.
Okay, let's hear from someone else.
I teach memoir writing, and this question's for Faye. And I'm always interested in the different ways that people approach writing memoir. And I'm wondering why you chose to write short stories as opposed to writing a straight memoir.
I have to say, whenever I do something, I research it thoroughly. So I read about 30 books on memoir and several memoirs. And I have had a life that there are parts of it where I'm still afraid of other people's slander and so forth. You know, remember the part, the good husband and bad husband? I said it into the mic. Now I'm dead. No. It was in order to disguise it so that there wouldn't be any aftermath, any fallout. But now that I said that, I pretty much destroyed the whole, you know, reason for doing it. Now that I fessed up. Just seemed more interesting, I think, too, for me.
Let's hear another comment or question.
I'm interested in your talents for observation in writing. Is that... I don't know quite how to word this, but I know when I'm writing, I sometimes, when trying to recall, I've lost the initial observation and feeling for it, and I know some people have a great talent for that. How much, when you think of a scene, how much comes out of your head, how much comes out of your memory, having actually remembered a close observation, and how do you meld it together? This isn't fiction.
Good question.
Very good.
Well, that is a very good question, because the whole quality of literature is so dependent on good observation. Just like painting is so dependent on it. And I paint as well. And I'm a landscape painter. And I've painted for years. And I paint with really professional guys that sell their paintings for thousands of dollars, and I just sort of tag along, and I just watch how they observe every, you know, just this little shadow and this the twist of this tree, and they know what to take out and enhance it and interpret it so it pops out. And And literature is not really that different, and so, you know, I do keep a notebook, and when I hear a particularly interesting dialogue, I'll make a note about that just so that I'll remember some of the syntax and the way that person said that, you know, that was so quaint and so clever, and so I do that, and I have these pages and pages of rhetoric. I call it rhetoric. That are in my computer, just a Word document of just random phrases and stuff that, you know, as I'm writing, I can go through, and it's amazing how something like that comes back and inspires you with the work that you're currently working on. You know, you can see this is something I can use, this is something that, or something akin to this can be worked in, and this could be really interesting and could draw a writer in. Yeah.
I like that question a lot, because I've always said nothing bad can happen to a writer. Everything's material, and everything that's material, you have to get it, observe it. And since I got obsessed with writing about 3 years ago, what started a writer's group and everything, everything I hear, I love to eavesdrop now. I practically eavesdrop with a notebook. It's just wonderful how something can spark something for you. I just look at it as the world's, people's lives are a great big playground for me now. In fact, I just wrote a poem about a niece who came home early from a mission. I called it Tea Party, talking about her companion growing thorns where she used to have skin and so forth. And the last line was, She sets down her black chunk of night, lifts her mother's homemade bread to her tongue.
I'm not a very organized recorder of things I observe quite yet. I think I'm still working on my process, but recently someone gave me a little, one of those really sleek little recorders, voice recorders, and I really like taking that places and having it in my pocket, and yeah, making sure no one knows that I have it, but yeah, recording bits of dialogue like that, and then I'm able to recall, you know, kind of like the sort of atmosphere that particular you know, discussion or whatever bit of dialogue that I heard. A notebook and sometimes letting something sit in your memory for a really long time and not writing it down, I think, can be an interesting thing too when you're recalling back on something you want to write about.
I just want to make one comment, but I can't resist making. I want to ask Larry, or maybe he can tell me later, how many women professors he's known who rent out rooms in their house. Since I'm an English professor who rents out rooms in my house, and I have a written list of rules, and I go to Germany every summer.
Let me get a good look at you. I want to observe. Can I follow you around today? Take my little notebook.
And I'm currently advertising for new ones on Craigslist because the last one moved out yesterday.
Uh-huh.
The Bulgarian moved out.
Oh.
And she's also a terrific writer, so she can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's material for your writing as well.
One of the classic pieces of literature that prompted me to write this in its structure is Boccaccio's De Camerone or Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, where, you know, you have a group of interesting people all gathered around. They've all got their own little stories and anecdotes, and you know, they're conflicting with each other. You should have let her move in. That would have really spiced things up. Thank you.
Well, what Faye said echoed something I was thinking, which is, yeah, eavesdropping, which, you know, is supposed to be a bad thing. If you're interested in people and you're interested in writing, don't censor your eavesdropping. Listen carefully. And now, of course, with cell phones, you hear maybe way too much of people's lives who don't seem to care that in public they're talking to somebody that everybody within distance can hear stories going on, and you wonder what the missing pieces are. But this is what writing reflects, or can, being a close observer of human interaction and being interested in a positive way in how other people think and react, and then using that, not verbatim, of course, but using it to understand something you might be writing about. So, do we have another question or comment?
May I just say that Paul is the quintessential eavesdropper. If you read his poetry, I mean, he is a master of it. His mind is like a steel trap. He'll just pick out these little trendy phrases and put them in a poem. It's so clever and funny and witty.
Thank you.
And you know, as old as you are, and you're older than I am, you know, it's amazing.
I'm older than almost anybody.
It's quite amazing you can remember these little things.
Well, and I want to mention something that Larry has coming up. Actually, I want Larry to mention it. Something going on at King's English in September that you should all be interested in and aware of. Will you tell about it, please?
Yeah, this spring, Idaho State University, where I went to read from The Jaeger Artist, my first novel, the chairman of the drama department just loved the dialogue and wanted to create a reader's theater. of some of the chapters from it, because she felt they just were perfect, the dramatic tension, and she did like the dialogue. I was very flattered by all that, and so she organized a Reader's Theater up in the new Performing Arts Center at Idaho State in Pocatello this spring, and came off very, very well. At least I loved it. It's just so interesting to see people taking your language, and it's different from reading, which is very passive, you know. To see the people acting out and you know, pronouncing the words that you wrote is just so gratifying. But anyway, they're coming down here to perform this on one night at King's English, and it probably will be around the middle weekend of September, something like that. But King's English normally publishes these in the paper. But, probably a Friday or Saturday night, mid-September is the way it's looking.
Well, I, for one, will be looking forward to that. Well, you know, we still got 15 minutes of time on the CD they're making of this. So anybody else want to pitch in or
we just break early.
Or anything any of you want to say before we close?
I like everybody in this room because I think you're all writers or interested in writing. So I feel a kinship now that I'm, you know, trying to join your club.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.